Welcome to Encounter. I'm Margaret Coffey. It's London, February 1801, the outset of an eventful year and an extraordinary century. The Emperor Napoleon is hatching, and just a few years in advance of Charles Darwin, 10 years ahead of Dickens, John Henry Newman is born. Newman becomes an outstanding figure of his century, first as an Anglican and leader of the Oxford movement or Tractarians, and then famously as a Catholic. People are drawn to him and divide over him. He opposes the inopportune declaration of papal infallibility at the First Vatican Council and becomes a catalyst for a wave of conversions to Catholicism. His influence stretches to the colonies. His image appears in St Mary's Cathedral in Sydney. Post-Federation Australians memorialise him. Later, the ecumenical movement and the Second Vatican Council are seen to be fruits of his work. And most recently, the health of our universities is tested against his idea. This encounter is an anniversary reflection, a series of snapshots of Newman. He lived a long life and his range was huge. So how is this 19th century figure a resource for the 21st century? What do we make of Newman now? What kind of Anglican or Catholic, theologian, philosopher, polemicist, poet or priest? It's interesting.
There's a very profoundly conservative side to Newman's thought, which appeals to traditionalists and to those who wish to maintain the orthodox tradition. And the paradox, in a way, is that before the Second Vatican Council, Newman was still slightly suspect as a kind of liberal. Since the Second Vatican Council, he's been a sort of rallying point for people who want to maintain his own position in its full integrity. If you like, he still has a prophetic role to balance what is in danger of becoming unbalanced within the Catholic Church.
Newman biographer Sheridan Gilley. There's a great deal of claiming of Newman going on. In ways that may not be coherent or even transparent, he's become a party man, attached to causes and reinterpretations. This is a snapshot of Newman in 2001, working at balancing a liberal impetus that has gone too far.
There's a misunderstanding of Newman's idea of doctrinal development among liberals, who seem to think that when Newman said, "Here below, to be perfect is to have changed often," he was justifying any kind of change. He was seeking to justify the kind of change within the Church which is actually true to the tradition of the Church. That, I think, is a very important caveat in it to the blanket application of certain phrases from his work on the development of Christian doctrine, which, you know, could actually take the Church in the wrong direction if left to go their own way.
It's often said nowadays that Newman is appealed to by almost every possible position or point of view within the Church. That's true. Some people seem to find that terribly surprising. I don't, because something similar is true of Martin Luther, Thomas Aquinas, if I may say so, Jesus Christ. But you know, there isn't a single party or school or whatever within the Church which doesn't claim to be thinking like Aquinas thought. But they can't all be quite right, can they, you know?
Nicholas Lash. He's Professor of Divinity at Cambridge.
I mean, the best of Newman scholarship doesn't, and the best is true, also best Aquinas scholarship, the best biblical scholarship, doesn't claim or pretend that Newman or Aquinas or the scriptures are the private possession of a single party. It's the mark of the second rate to say only we understand they've got him or it on our side, you know? No, the idea that we could sort of thin things out so that each of us was a sort of an exact representative of only one point of view would be loopy. People aren't like that. Cultures aren't like that. Part of Newman's greatness is he understood, if you like, the constitutive paradox, rather like a much more straightforwardly theological theologian than Newman 100 years later, namely Karl Rahner. Part of Rahner's greatness is that he understood the extent to which things are construct in paradox and tension. The fact that where Newman's thought is concerned, where the appropriation of Newman's thought, the appeal to his authority, if you like, or patronage by all sorts of different schools and trains of climate of belief in Catholicism and Christianity more generally, always reminds me of a Cambridge scholar of several generations ago who said famously, "You can find anything that you want in the writings of the fathers of the Church, provided only that your edition has a good index and you don't look up all the references."
1864. Newman publishes his most famous reference, his account of his conversion.
"I was brought up from a child to take great delight in reading the Bible, but I had no formed religious convictions till I was 15. I used to wish the Arabian tales were true. My imagination ran on unknown influences, on magical powers and talismans. I thought life might be a dream, or I an angel and all this world a deception, my fellow angels by a playful device concealing themselves from me and deceiving me with the semblance of a material world."
Well, I'm a Newmaniac, of course. So, I think I've published now 20 books on Newman one way or another, so I've spent a lot of my life with him. And he's been a huge influence on me. And I've no doubt that he will be canonized and that he'll be made Doctor of the Church. And he'll be seen, I think, particularly as a Doctor of the Church relevant to the times in which we live, that's to say the post-Vatican II Church.
Ian Carr's biography of Newman was published in 1988.
He did feel things very much. He was very sensitive. And there was a great sort of toughness about him, combined with this very, very sort of thrilling kind of sensitivity. Some of the pictures, there's a particularly one of him as an old man, which was very falsifying, really, because it brings out this sensitivity to such an extent that it obscures this other side of him that I'm talking about and makes him look just sort of rather weak and sort of sentimental. And the best picture is the drawing by Lady Coleridge, which brings out both these qualities I've been talking about, but also this sense of mystery people had when they met him. There was a strange sort of people, a lot of people commented on this.
In James Froude's image from the 1830s, Newman's appearance is striking. This Anglican clergyman is tall and spare, the most impressive person Froude has ever seen. He has a large head and his face is remarkably like that of Julius Caesar. Both were formed by nature to command others.
People who heard him, especially preach in St. Mary's, Oxford, there's a famous description, of course, by Matthew Arnold of that, remembered this voice. It was a kind of, hard to find the exact word, vibrant. It was a voice that people never forgot. It's extraordinary the number of references to it throughout the 19th century, people who had heard him. Of course, he didn't do any of the things we'd expect from preachers today. And the sermons, as an Anglican, were read out anyway, so he just stood in the pulpit without any gestures at all, reading out the text, and in this low, thrilling voice. I think that's the best description of the voice. People who did stay to listen definitely became hooked. He also broke the rules, because we would see them today. He spoke very rapidly, but then there were these long pauses, and there was one famous sermon which Froude heard. In fact, many people remember this moment in their lives. Newman was preaching on the crucifixion and speaking of the Roman soldier who struck him, and Newman said, "And this was the Son of God." And Froude said people suddenly realized what the incarnation really was, but there was this lengthy pause after he'd said it. So that was the way he preached. He spoke rapidly, but there were these long, pregnant pauses.
"When I was 15 in the autumn of 1816, a great change of thought took place in me. I fell under the influence of a definite creed and received into my intellect impressions of dogma which, through God's mercy, have never been effaced or obscured. I believed that the inward conversion, of which I was conscious and of which I still am more certain than that I have hands and feet, would last into the next life, and that I was elected to eternal glory. I retained it till the age of 21, when it gradually faded away, but I believe that it had some influence on my opinions, making me rest in the thought of two and two only supreme and luminously self-evident beings, myself and my Creator."
People have sometimes thought that his family were sort of keen evangelicals. They weren't at all. They were ordinary, very ordinary Church of England people. And he came from a background which was not particularly religious. It was more his grandmother and aunt who influenced him, because he, for some reason, when he was a very little boy, he used to go there a lot and stay there, and it was they who first read the Bible to him and got him to read the Bible, and I think that was a very important influence on his life. And, of course, he himself underwent a conversion at the age of 15, and it was an evangelical type of conversion. That was quite common. George Eliot, at exactly the same age, under the influence of a school teacher, had exactly the same sort of conversion, although she later abandoned Christianity.
Yes, I think there was a sense in which from his original evangelical conversion at the age of 15, he always was an evangelical, because Protestant evangelicalism gave him this initial sense of the all-reality of God, and oddly enough, the all-reality of his own soul. And it's those two things which were more real to him than anything else, and he carried that from his teenage years right to the end of his life.
This is a new emphasis in Newman's studies. The profoundest continuity in Newman, writes Gilly, was with his evangelical beginnings in God's self-revelation towards him, which was also his discovery of himself. Gilly argues that in Newman, you see the 19th century Catholic revival had its beginnings in the Protestant tradition. Newman travels to Italy, an Anglican clergyman still. The religious practices he observes there appall him.
I'm up in arms against the Shelleyism of the day, which resolves religion into feeling and makes it possible for bad men to have holy thoughts. Doubtless, no religious emotion is worth a straw, or rather, it is pernicious if it does not lead to practice.
But Sicily is like the Garden of Eden. The journey is eventful and difficult. On the way home, between Sardinia and Corsica, the boat is becalmed, and Newman writes a poem. Once home, Newman is immediately launched into controversy. He becomes part of a group grown out of Oxford University. They issue tracts carrying forward a debate about Anglican identity. The Church of England would be Catholic, but it would stand also against popery on the one hand and dissent on the other.
While an awful lot of work's been done on the Catholic Newman, I think the Tractarian and Anglican Newman had been put under less scrutiny, and I think it had something to say about the later Newman as well. The fierceness of Newman as an Anglican became apparent, and sometimes those who contrasted it with a softer side that emerged in the later 1850s onwards as a Catholic, when he seemed perhaps more at ease with himself. There was a progression there, and in a sense the Via Media High Church phase was a stage in his development, and he didn't stop there. And it's often been commented upon that how many of the Tractarian converts to Rome hadn't been reared as high churchmen or old high churchmen. They'd come from evangelical households, and those households, going back a few generations, had often previously been high church. There's a sort of dynamism there in that wing of the movement.
Peter Knuckles, who has written about Newman the Anglican in his book on the Oxford movement.
When the centenary of Newman's death occurred in 1990, there was a tremendous outburst of ecumenical gatherings all over the world to celebrate the ecumenical Newman, the Newman who had been an Anglican and who became a Catholic, and who was to be as much honoured by Anglicans as by Catholics. But there has been something of a shift, I think, in the scholarship of the subject since then, especially by writers like Dr. Peter Knuckles, and they stress that before Newman came along in the 1830s to help create the Oxford movement, to try to push the Church of England in a Catholic direction, to affirm its character as part of the International Catholic Church of Christ. The Church of England was getting along with a fairly comfortable view of itself as both Catholic and Protestant, and perhaps in a sense liberal.
Newman's preference always was for a sort of more cut-and-dried system. He'd, while disagreeing profoundly, had a sort of admiration for Calvinism. It was a real system. You feel he's carving out a sort of an Anglican system almost to match those other systems, Lutheranism, Calvinism, Catholicism. It's a real religion. It's something more than a paper theory. And in the end, the attempt fails. He has doubts and then a crisis of confidence. But this process does, I think, have the effect of prising open latent differences which had more happily coexisted in the Church of England. Party strife engendered by the Oxford movement, I think, can't be denied, and Newman had a part to play in that. I mean, he almost took some of his correspondents, a secret delight in provoking and forcing people to take their stand.
And in a way, Newman's crusade to make the Church of England more Catholic created almost a kind of identity crisis in the Church of England as to whether it was really more in tune with the Reformation or the Counter-Reformation or the 18th century Enlightenment. I think the view of Newman's role in the Church of England now is more that in forcing these choices upon the Church of England, Newman left the Church of England in the process of dividing itself into three major parties, Catholic, Protestant, and Liberal, which still divide it today. And in that respect, Newman's legacy to the Church of England has been a very ambiguous one.
I always sleep better after music. There must be some electric current passing from the strings through the fingers into the brain and down the spinal marrow. Perhaps thought is music.
He loved Beethoven. Well, when Newman was a schoolboy, he learned to play the violin. And he gave this up when he became a Catholic priest. He didn't really think it was quite part of the dignity of the priesthood to do this. But after he read the Apologia, two of his old Anglican friends gave him a violin. And he continued to play the violin then for the rest of his life. He had little quartets with his own priests and with the schoolboys in the school which he founded in Birmingham. Yes, he loved Beethoven.
I mean, one has to remember that the early Victorians were very unlike the late Victorians, very unlike, you know, the stereotype of the stiff upper lip Englishman who not showing any emotions. That was brought about, really, I suppose, by Dr. Arnold of Rugby and the growth of the British Empire. But Newman belonged to the early Victorian generation, and they showed their feelings and emotions quite freely. I mean, he belonged to the same sort of world as Charles Dickens. And when you think that he preached that famous sermon, the second spring, on the restoration of the Catholic hierarchy to this country, and all the bishops were in tears in the chapel. I mean, that's quite remarkable. I don't know if our hierarchy would burst into tears today on hearing a sermon. You know, they were very different from what people have come to think of the English as.
In the years that follow, Newman is at the centre of controversy within Anglicanism.
As an Anglican, he was the leader of the Oxford or Tractarian movement, that movement that was seeking to Catholicize the Church of England or to restore or rediscover or recover its Catholic character. And so he was involved in huge controversies with Anglican evangelicals and liberals.
What will best describe my state of mind at the early part of 1839 is an article in the British Critic for that April. It contains the last words I ever spoke as an Anglican to Anglicans. It considers the dry and superficial religious teaching and the literature of the last generation or century, and as a result, the need felt by both the hearts and the intellects of the nation for a deeper philosophy. First, I mentioned the literary influence of Sir Walter Scott, who turned men's minds to the direction of the Middle Ages. the general need, I said, of something deeper and more attractive than what had offered itself elsewhere may be considered to have led to his popularity. He reacted on his readers, stimulating their mental thirst, feeding their hopes, setting before them visions which, when once seen, are not easily forgotten, and silently indoctrinating them with nobler ideas.
This is the period when Newman confronts his own accusation that the Catholic Church illegitimately added to the creeds of the ancient church. 1844, he thinks and writes his way towards Catholicism in an essay on the development of Christian doctrine.
That is to say that Christianity doesn't fall full-blown from the pages of the New Testament. Christianity is an historical product. It's something in which the teaching of our Lord was actually taken up by the apostles and then by the Christian church and developed over the centuries. In other words, Christianity isn't essentially something static. It's something dynamic. It's something which actually changes with time and with historical experience. And therefore, the church in the modern world must be as open to that possibility of change as the church was open to that change in the early centuries of the Christian era.
It is sometimes said that the stream is clearest near the spring. Whatever use may fairly be made of this image, it does not apply to the history of a philosophy or belief, which, on the contrary, is more equable and purer and stronger when its bed has become deep and broad and full. It necessarily arises out of an existing state of things, and for a time savours of the soul. In time, it enters upon strange territory. Points of controversy alter their bearing, and old principles reappear under new forms. It changes with them in order to remain the same. In a higher world, it is otherwise, but here below, to live is to change. And to be perfect is to have changed often.
Here are views of Newman's theory of the development of doctrine from two different vantage points. Sheridan Gilley.
He was seeking to justify the kind of change within the church which is actually true to the tradition of the church. So while, you know, he might appear to be liberal in his justification of change, he's conservative in the sense that he wants that change to be of a particular kind. There are certain sorts of safeguard which guarantee the continuing orthodoxy of the church as the Spirit leads it into new truth. And that, I think, is a very important caveat, you know, to the blanket application of certain phrases from his work on the development of Christian doctrine, which, you know, could actually take the church in the wrong direction if left to go their own way.
And Nicholas Lash.
I haven't seen learned articles and studies on the development of doctrine for about 20 years now, and there's a good reason for that, I think. In the 18th century, there was no interest whatsoever in the idea that truth might have a history. If it's true, it's true, it's true for all times and all places. This is how scientists thought, this is how philosophers thought, this is how theologians thought. It's only through the Romantic movement and then on through the 19th century that gradually the recognition that all events have histories and that all accounts of things have histories broke through slowly. I suppose people think of Darwin somewhat at the centre of this, you see. It breaks through eventually, even into physics and so on, though this tends to come rather late, and unsurprisingly breaks through fairly slowly in religious thought as well. You see, beneath the desire to say, well, look, if it's true, it must be timeless, is the fear that to admit otherwise would be to say, well, if it's temporal, then it must be temporary, which actually, of course, doesn't follow, but that's the fear. Now, Newman's theory of development, I mean, when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species a few years later, several of Newman's friends said, but good heavens, you got there first, you were onto this, not, of course, talking about biological evolution, but about social evolution, social change, if you like. in a sense, they're contemporary figures working with the same wind, let's put it that way. But what's interesting is I wrote a book about some 30 years ago trying to, if you like, show that Newman, in some important sense, didn't have a theory of development. His theory, if you like, was that you could use the concept of development somehow to take a middle position between fixity and total flux. What I think eventually happened, and here when Newman's essay did begin to have an influence, sometime from about, again, the 1960s onwards, as people have begun to recognize in a way that you needn't be that frightened of change. Changes aren't all for the good, aren't all for the worse. But to say that things have changed is not to say, oh, now therefore everything's kind of up for grabs. It's simply a matter of attempting the exhausting business of learning that you have continually to be rethinking your relationship. Take, for example, the truth of Scripture. The truth of Scripture is, if you like, let's say, secured historically, not by hanging on to something which was never changed, or think of it only as some way very, very mildly and slowly mutating, we call that development, not real change, but by recognizing that in changing times, in changing circumstances, you have to work extremely hard to keep rediscovering, recovering, in different circumstances, the ancient truth. It's a quite different kind of model. And as that sort of penny dropped, and as that way of thinking about things became, if you like, congenial to people, and this happened, I think, sometime around the 1970s, then the need for devices known as theories of doctrinal development fades away.
And then later on, when he became a Catholic, he found himself again caught up in that struggle between the ultramontanes and more liberally minded Catholics, that ultramontane movement, which led finally to the definition of papal infallibility in 1870. So Newman found himself in the Catholic Church involved in a great deal of controversy, and again he made a lot of enemies, and certainly I regard this as a sign of his great integrity. He remained firmly loyal to the Catholic Church in its tradition and accepted the definition of papal infallibility in the very moderate form in which it was passed, and yet at the same time he was also very critical of the ultramontanes.
This age of the Church is peculiar. In former times, primitive and medieval, there was not the extreme centralization which now is in use. If a private theologian said anything free, another answered him. If the controversy grew, then it went to a bishop, a theological faculty, or to some foreign university. The Holy See was but the court of ultimate appeal. Now, if I, as a private priest, put anything into print, propaganda answers me at once. How can I fight with such a chain upon my arm? 'Tis like the Persians driven on to fight under the lash.
Newman had some very interesting things to say at the time of the First Vatican Council and after the Council about councils. And I think he'd been, of course, fascinated by Vatican II and what has happened since Vatican II. He certainly predicted Vatican II. He said there will be another council. And that was, in some ways, an unusual thing to say at the time, because many people thought that the definition of papal infallibility would mean there wouldn't be any more councils, because most councils had been called upon to deal with heresies. And in future, the Pope would be able to do that himself, so there wouldn't be any need for a council. But Newman saw quite clearly that the definition of papal infallibility by itself needed filling out, that a much larger and wider statement about the Church needed to be made, about the nature of the Church. And that is exactly what, of course, happened at the Second Vatican Council in what I think is its greatest document, which is the Lumen Gentium, the Constitution on the Church. It's saying to the Eastern Orthodox, the Catholic Church is not primarily hierarchical, let alone petrine. It is primarily a sacrament. And then on the other hand, it's saying to Protestants, yes, we do believe in the ordained ministry, but we believe, first of all, in the priesthood of all believers, the baptized. It was that kind of theology that Newman pioneered in his own time, because what he was doing in Oxford in the 1830s, rediscovering the fathers, was what was to happen in France in the 20th century with the so-called ressourcement, going back to the sources. And without that ressourcement movement in France, I suppose, the Second Vatican Council would not have been possible.
What made the council possible in the first half of the 20th century was partly innumerable Catholic scholars frightened off doing theology head-on by the savagery of the repression of so-called modernism at the beginning of the 20th century, to keep their heads down beneath the parapet. They all went off and studied history instead, which was quite a good thing to do, because they rediscovered, just like the fathers of the Church, they rediscovered medieval theology. And a whole sense, a whole richness of theological soil in terms of style, in terms of imagery, in terms of character, bubbled up, which in fact made possible the achievement of Vatican II. Now, Newman himself never was trained as or thought as a neo-scholastic. He was saturated in the writings of the fathers of the church. He knew his scriptures well, he knew his fathers well. He thought like a literary thinker, rather, if you like, than a more technically abstract philosopher. And I think this is part of what then helped to make him seem a surprisingly contemporary figure 70 years after his death. It's interesting that one of the very few texts of Newman's, which did have some slight direct influence on one of the council documents, was the marvelous essay which Newman wrote as an old man in 1877. It was the preface to the third edition of his lectures on the Via Media of the Anglican Church. He portrays the church as a body construct out of the tensions between three of its own constitutive impulses, the impulses to sanctity, to truth, and to order, and sees the church as healthy when those tensions are held in balance, and unhealthy or becoming corrupted when any one or two of those impulses or constitutive tensions kind of takes over, dominates the other two. And of course, the point about Vatican I, and if Newman were alive today, I'm quite sure he would say about how the Roman Curia still behaves and thinks in the year 2001, these are precisely examples of the impulse to order tending to override and to dominate the impulses to holiness and truth. Now, that particular essay of his, which I'm not alone in thinking is where our understanding of the mystery of the church is concerned, is one of the most profound things ever written, a view also shared by the late Cardinal Congar. Now, Congar was on the commission that helped to draft the Constitution Lumen Gentium, and there are a couple of paragraphs in Lumen Gentium which show, via Congar's hand, the influence of that piece of writing of Newman's. That's one of the very few places where there's a kind of fairly direct influence.
In that way, Newman was always dynamic. He would have said that the church goes on, you know. See, he would have said to liberals, sort of extreme liberals, he'd say, well, look, the Second Vatican Council is not the beginning of the church, you know. There's 2,000 years going before it. On the other hand, he would say to the integralists, the conservatives, the extreme conservatives, that the Second Vatican Council is a genuine and authentic council and is a very important council in the life of the church. What Newman was really against was any kind of fundamentalism, because he saw life in terms of dynamism and change and movement and development.
It's 1864. Newman writes about the spirit of the age and the disturbance to religious faith occasioned by the new certainties of science.
We live in a wonderful age. The enlargement of the circle of secular knowledge just now is simply a bewilderment, and the more so because it has the promise of continuing. Now, these discoveries, certain or probable, have, in matter of fact, an indirect bearing upon religious opinions. And the question arises, how are the respective claims of revelation and of natural science to be adjusted? Few minds in earnest can remain at ease without some sort of rational grounds for their religious belief. To reconcile theory and fact is almost an instinct of the mind. When, then, a flood of facts, ascertained or suspected, comes pouring in upon us, all believers in revelation, be they Catholic or not, are aroused to consider their bearing upon themselves.
Newman is not only, in a certain sense, a liberal in the sense that he actually wanted a church which was more responsive to its laity and to its theologians. But he was also, in a way, a great critic of modernity as such, and he's the great intellectual analyst of the reasons why people don't actually believe. He's the great opponent of the notion, for example, that anybody can simply adopt their own religion on the basis of their private individual reasoning. He thinks that we all are possessed by ideas, even if we're not conscious of them, that we are influenced by the spirit of the age, by the tradition from which we come. And the first principles of clear reasoning are to try to get to the bottom of them, to try to see exactly what they are. Now, the whole Christian vision of things, of course, also rests upon certain assumptions. And one of his great intellectual enterprises in his university sermons and in his last major work, The Grammar of Assent, is to show that the Christian is just as reasonable in holding to his assumptions as the non-believer is reasonable in holding to his.
In the 17th century, everybody believed in God. In the 18th century, the highly educated increasingly didn't, and were suspect for that reason. In the 19th century, the educated and the prosperous increasingly didn't, but for heaven's sake, don't frighten the horses or tell the servants or the lower classes this. Well, by the time we come to the beginning of the 21st century, certainly in Britain, as in the United States, and I suspect something similar is true of Australia, the principal intellectual movers and shakers in the culture take it for granted that only children and the superstitious go to church and believe in God. Now, that's a rather cynical summary of a massive process usually described as secularization. And I don't think it's secularization at all, because secularization implies a diminishing of belief. I think people are come to believe all sorts of other things. I mean, there's never been, as superstitious a period in Western culture than we have at the moment, when the bookshops are awash with stuff on tarot and this and that and the other. Wild. So it's not that people cease to believe, that they cease the beliefs gone wild, if you like, put it that way. Now, in the middle of the 19th century, one of the greatest, darkest philosophers, Nietzsche, also one of the genuinely great atheists of the 19th century, because Nietzsche knew that atheism matters. He was a passionate atheist, which is part of, if you like, what drove him mad. Is the world, the totality of everything, is the world a fact or is it a creature? Is it just there or is it created? Now, somebody who knows that that question makes absolutely all the difference in the world to everything is somebody who either genuinely believes in God or genuinely doesn't. Because most people are either very lazy theists or very lazy atheists who don't see what's at issue. Newman, like Nietzsche, knew that it makes all the difference in the world whether or not we are creatures. And therefore what Martin Buber was to call the eclipse of God, going on like the dark shadow coming over the moon, going on during the 19th century, greatly disturbed the great believers like Newman and the great unbelievers like Nietzsche. They have in common that they know that this matters. The disturbing thing for some of us about the present condition of our culture is that so many people, even so many religious believers, think it really doesn't matter at all.
In 1865, Newman's longest poem, The Dream of Gerontius, is published in Miss Fanny Taylor's new periodical, The Month. The poem depicts the death of Gerontius and the journey of his soul towards the judgment seat of God. Here is a footnote about why it matters whether or not we are creatures, and why Newman's engagement with the philosophy of belief still has bearing.
Of course, the question of the relationship between religion and ethics is extremely complicated and a difficult one. On the other hand, there is much, much more unacknowledged dependence on theological issues in the formulation of ethical questions than most people appreciate. For me, a classic instance of this is the increasingly widespread talk about rights. Everything is talking about rights, human rights. There is, however, a very simple question, which is much, much more difficult to answer than I think most people appreciate, which is, well, how come human rights? What gave human beings human rights? Anyone can claim, but the mere fact that I claim I have a right doesn't give me a right. What actually is the ground, not of claim talk? I have a right to freedom, truth, property, whatever it may be. How come rights? Now, in fact, of course, rights talk is grounded in a theological account of the dignity of human being. And once you simply excise that from it, rights talk becomes, I believe, at root incoherent, even if it's not recognized to be such. This is an extremely interesting philosophical question, which is rarely considered. And one of the reasons why it's rarely considered is that you can't address it seriously, I think, without acknowledging that at root it is also a theological question. And this, of course, our culture is reluctant to do.
1870. Newman publishes An Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent, an essay about the structure of belief.
I came to the conclusion that there was no medium in true philosophy between atheism and Catholicity, and that a perfectly consistent mind, under those circumstances in which it finds itself here below, must embrace either the one or the other. And I hold this still. I am a Catholic by virtue of my believing in a God. And if I am asked why I believe in a God, I answer that it is because I believe in myself. For I feel it impossible to believe in my own existence, and of that fact I am quite sure, without believing also in the existence of Him who lives as a personal, all-seeing, all-judging being in my conscience. I think I have a strong true meaning in what I say, which will stand examination.
The Grammar of Assent explains how that meaning will withstand examination. It examines what we mean by certainty, how we arrive there, and its relationship with faith. Newman was old, weak, and weary, but for years he'd wanted to give popular, practical, and personal evidence of Christianity, as contrasted to scientific evidence. He wanted to show that any individual, high or low, mid-19th century factory girl or philosopher, has the right, or the real rational grounds, to be certain in religious belief, and is justified in believing what he or she may not be able to prove.
Part of what's attractive about Newman, there are many things unattractive about it. I find him infuriating as a human being very often, but that doesn't stop me immensely admiring the mind, is there's a kind of concreteness. There's never, in an inappropriate sense, abstractness in the sense of an unhingedness from the actual facts and circumstances of human life and behaviour. One of the things which makes the grammar extremely interesting still is that if you say, well, of course, where particular concrete facts are concerned, you can never be absolutely sure about them. You can only think that it's more and more likely, what Newman called the accumulation of probabilities, to which Newman's answer, well, hang on, this is nonsense. I mean, take an example he loved giving. Great Britain is an island. Now, somebody could say, but how can you be really sure? I mean, you've never actually sailed around it yourself. Even if you had, couldn't your compass have been wrong? And do you really trust all the map makers and so on, you see? To which Newman's characteristic reply would be, if you don't acknowledge yourself, look at your own actual thinking, but you are certain, then you're loopy, you know. Now, the question then is, how did you manage to become certain? You clearly have become certain. And if you deny that, you're denying your own psychological condition, you see. Come clean, be honest with yourself. Now the question is, how did you manage it? What Newman noticed, because he was a good psychologist, if you like, I mean, amateur psychologist as well as a philosopher, is that in fact, well, I've often said to students that it's very important not to take important decisions, because the really important decisions are the ones that you will discover eventually you have taken. Certitude, in other words, in concrete matters, is, if you like, recognized retrospectively. It's not forwardly achieved. You can't say, and I take a deep breath and become certain. What you can discover is, if your mind has settled into conviction. Yes, I'm not going up to university. I am going to emigrate, whatever it is. And I think that's one of the things that's still fascinating to philosophers and psychologists, for example, about what Newman has to say about belief and about certitude. Oh, my God.
1885. Newman receives in the post the edition of the Dream of Gerontius found in the body of General Gordon of Khartoum. Gordon had marked it in places, showing Newman said that Gordon was always in his deathbed, fulfilling the common advice that we should ever pass the day as if it was to be our last. 1889. A copy of Gordon's book is given to Elgar on his wedding day. 1890, February the 21st, John Henry Newman dies.
Time is short. Eternity is long.
Whether people have any interest in philosophy or education or Christianity or whatever it may be, if they have a love for the English language, they should find Newman worth reading. Anyone interested in, for example, questions about the philosophy of belief and so on, will still find much in Newman's University Sermons and the Grammar of Assent that's interesting. And where Christians are concerned, he's a very, very non-clerical kind of thinker. His ability to hold together concretely and attractively an absolutely central sense that we do not go after God. We find that God has moved there first. The sense of the primacy of grace, not talked about in kind of abstractly clerical terms, but in very concrete terms. People who want to learn how to pray can do worse than to read Newman, because of this pervasive sense of the primacy, the prevenience of the presence of God in everything we do and think and suffer and so on. If they want somebody nice and tidy, you'll give them all the answers. They better go and read somebody else.
In this encounter, you heard Sheridan Gilley, Ian Carr, Nicholas Lash, and Peter Knuckles, all of whom have written about Newman in recent years. If you go to RN's website, abc.net.au/RN, and locate Encounter, you'll find there a list of books published by these authors, along with the text of the program. Technical production, Melissa May. I'm Margaret Coffey.